I actually think that debates about the foundations of mathematics are rather confused. I think the days where we thought we could get by with a sort of universal foundation for mathematics is just a feature of the history of math, history of the philosophy of mathematics, which has now disappeared. There's just a whole variety of mathematics, plural, and to reduce the whole of mathematics to any kind of mathematics is just a hopeless enterprise.
Today is joining us from New York, Graham Priest, a philosopher who also studied mathematics and is well known for many things. Particularly, we will talk about contradictory logics, or logics where we can work with a contradiction without being able to prove everything. We'll talk about non-standard things, non-standard arithmetic, non-standard set theory, and how all this is philosophically motivated. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our next episode of the Logic Podcast about logic. And I'm very happy that Graham joined us from New York, who's quite well known for a couple of things, from Buddhist philosophy to dialectism to work on the foundations of math. Thanking you once again for joining.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I think there's one main theme a lot of philosophers think when they hear about you, and that's dialectism. Would you be so kind to say a few words about this branch of philosophy or this philosophy?
So in Western philosophy, there's been high orthodoxy for the last 2,500 years that contradictions can't be true. And dialectism is the view that some are true. Now, there have been a few people in the history of Western philosophy. Eastern philosophy is another subject. We can talk about that if you like, but let's just talk about Western philosophy for the moment. There have been a few exceptions to the orthodoxy in the history of Western philosophy. The most obvious example is Hegel. That's a contentious statement, but we can talk about that if you want. But generally speaking, the thought that some contradictions are true and the movement that is so, is a relatively modern phenomenon. And it comes from a slightly surprising direction, which is formal logic itself. In the last 50 or 60 years, we've seen the development of branches of logic called paraconsistent logic, which roughly speaking mean the systems of logic where you can have a contradiction without all hell breaking loose, which is, of course, a necessary condition for considering the possibility that some contradictions might be true. And dialectism is exactly the view that some contradictions are true. And so this has been a debate that's been going on in metaphysics, foundations of logic, formal logic now for 40 or 50 years. And the word dialetheia is a neologism, which I coined with my now sadly deceased colleague, Richard Sylvan. A dialetheia is just a true contradiction. And so dialectism is the view that some contradictions are true.
No, that sounds interesting. Could you say a few words? What do you need to tweak on classical logic in order to omit the explosion principle that everything follows from one contradictions? Are there different strengths, or how to do that?
Yeah. Look, there are many different paraconsistent logics. And they work on very different principles. I mean, modern non-classical logic uses many different techniques, and virtually any technique that you can use to construct a non-classical logic can be used to construct a paraconsistent logic. The important thing is that explosion has to go. Explosion is the view that a contradiction implies everything. If that goes...
So is this ex falso quod libet? I mean, sorry. Is this ex falso quod libet, or is it something else, or P, not P and not P?
Okay, ex falso quod libet could mean a few different things.
But false, everything false.
Well, look, explicitly it's from P and not P, Q follows. So for any P and Q, from P and not P, Q follows. So it's a version of ex falso. But the explosion is connected with other principles. the most obvious is the disjunctive syllogism. If P and not P or Q, then Q. So there are paraconsistent logics which retain the just disjunctive syllogism, but in most paraconsistent logics, that goes as well.
Can you maybe explain a little? I mean, I'm not a, I'm not a classical logician. I'm intuitionist, and I, yeah. So for me, the question for what's truth is maybe slightly misleading, or it's not one which I find particularly enlightening. But I guess for you, truth is quite important, right?
No, it isn't.
I mean,
the view is that some contradictions are true. What I mean by truth, anything you can choose, right? And it can be an intuitionist notion of truth. It can be a notion of truth where truth is identified with warranted assertability. It can be a correspondence theory of truth. It can be a deflationist theory of truth. It can be a coherence theory of truth. I don't mind. I mean, I think the view is interesting, arguable, exciting, whatever you think the notion of truth is.
So I would say for me more important is the notion of evidence. How does this fit into your framework? I mean, truth is maybe just a word. A proposition holds if I have evidence for it. And you just say, so you could use this as truth or as in a more generalized sense, truth values, right?
So unless you think that truth is identical as verification, which is a view, but not one that I hold, then there's a distinction between what is true and what's known to be true, at least rationally believed to be true. And that's a question of evidence. So as David Hume says, the wise person apportions their beliefs according to the evidence. So if I say that some things are true and you ask me, well, give me some examples, and why should I believe those are true? Then we turn to the evidence for such claims. And that, of course, is going to depend on what those claims are.
So I would actually identify whether a proposition holds versus whether I have evidence for it. So I guess that's the difference. Especially when we think about mathematics, I mean, reasoning in mathematics. To me, mathematics is something I construct in my head. So the notion of truth, which applies to the real world, is maybe a bit more problematic is certainly more problematic if we apply them to constructions we perform in our head. Right.
Well, I understand what the notion of truth is in intuitionist mathematics. You'd have to tell me more about what you understand truth to be outside mathematics. But maybe I should ask you that before we continue.
What was the question again? Was truth outside of mathematics? Realist notion. Yes.
Not everyone suddenly thinks that truth outside mathematics is realist.
Okay. Quite right. In quantum physics, this is also doubted, I guess. I would adopt this that there are sort of, as you say, different perspective on reasoning, and realism or is an idealized or a caricature of reasoning, right? Which I'm just using it to contrast it with reasoning in mathematics. Because I mean, reasoning about the real world refers to objects which we think we completely understand, which are outside, which are not, which are observable. Okay, I understand.
But look,
that's a bit of a caricature, right?
Okay, but look, we reason in a certain way when we do intrinsic mathematics. We reason in a certain way when we do classical mathematics. We reason in a certain way when we do paraconsistent mathematics. I don't think that's terribly contentious.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I guess maybe this is another key phrase for questioning you about pluralism in logic, and maybe pluralism in pure mathematics, and maybe even pure pluralism in applied mathematics. So How far would you push this idea that there are simply different things, they stand next to each other, there's not one true logic or not one true mathematics or not one true applied math? What are you thoughts about
that?
I think
it's absolutely crucial to distinguish between pure mathematics and applied mathematics. Pure mathematics is the study of structures, abstract structures. And we know there are abstract structures which are governed by classical logic, abstract structures which are governed by intuitionistic logic, abstract structures which are governed by paraconsistent mathematics. And you don't have to be a dialetheist or an intuitionist to find these important and interesting structures. So am I a pluralist about pure mathematics? Absolutely. When you apply a piece of mathematics in physics or linguistics or biology, you have to choose the right bit of mathematics to apply. And which is the right bit of mathematics to apply will depend, well, at least in the first instance, whether it gives the right empirical results. And that's always going to be an issue. So, there is an issue when you apply mathematics about as to which is the right bit of pure mathematics, or at least which is the best bit of pure mathematics. That doesn't arise when you're just doing pure mathematics.
Yeah, so I just wonder, so you were saying that sort of different kind of mathematics, maybe classical structures or intuitionistic structures, are appropriate for different applications, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether there is not, while there is maybe not sort of the perfect logic or a perfect system, whether some systems are maybe in a way better or better suited than others.
Well, that they are is undeniable. I mean, you know, just consider geometries. I mean, there are many geometries, right? And until relatively recently, it was assumed that one was the correct geometry for what you might call the canonical application of geometry, namely the charting the spatial or spatio-temporal structure of space. But now we think it isn't. So we've changed what we think the best mathematical structure is for that application.
But this is not really going to the sort of foundations of mathematics in a way. This is a particular way, I mean, for us, as you say, to model something in the real world, geometry, and it turns out that Euclidean geometry is not the right one for general relativity, and so on, right? But does this really affect the sort of foundations of reasoning?
Okay, well, if you want to talk about the foundations of mathematics, you're not talking about applications anymore. You're talking about pure mathematics, right?
Yes, that's true.
And I actually think that debates about the foundations of mathematics are rather confused. I think the days where we thought we could get by with a sort of universal foundation for mathematics is just a feature of the history of the philosophy of mathematics, which has now disappeared. I think one should recognize that there's just a whole variety of mathematics, plural, and to reduce the whole of mathematics to any kind of mathematics is just a hopeless enterprise.
Could you maybe help us to think about mathematical structures where paraconsistent logic is the counterpart, so to speak, in the foundation? I mean, we had some constructive math in this podcast already when Thorsten talked about his research. We assume classical math, so to speak. How would a structure look like where paraconsistent logic comes into play?
Well, there are many well-known inconsistent mathematics. There's set theories, topologies, arithmetics, and so on. So, for example, based on certain paraconsistent logics, you can have axiomatic theories of arithmetic, which are complete. They're inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
But what Gödel's theorem actually tells you, and I'm going to challenge this result, is that any arithmetic of a suitable expressive power is either inconsistent or incomplete. Now, if you're using classical logic and it's inconsistent, then it's silly because everything holds, right? But if you use a paraconsistent logic, that's not true. And we know that there are axiomatic mathematics, systems of mathematics, which are complete in the sense that everything true in the standard model is provable. So for any P, P or not P is true. But of course, they're inconsistent. And these structures are well known. There are still various open problems concerning them, but the systems themselves are relatively well understood.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Gödel's theorem also holds in integralistic mathematics. It's not dependent on classical reasoning.
Sure. In fact, it invokes very little mathematical reasoning. You certainly don't need classical mathematics or the full strength of intuitionist mathematics. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And now let me try to push this debate, like within pure mathematics, is then there a debate to be made about theory choice there, saying this particular research program yields to structures that we can handle quite well or is more fruitful?
No, I don't think there is a question of theory choice as far as pure mathematics goes. You don't have to choose whether you want to be a Euclidean geometry or a Riemannian geometry. They're both geometries. You can do both, right? Theory choice arises when you apply a piece of pure mathematics for a particular application. Then there is a question of which one gives you the best results. And if you want to say that when you're applying the mathematics, it gives you a theory of what it is you're applying the mathematics to, then you have a question of theory choice.
I'm a little puzzled whether there isn't like a question of fitting to the way we think, or maybe this is an artifact of how I was raised, so to speak, and if I would have been raised.
The way we think is a matter for cognitive psychologists. And what we know from cognitive psychology is that most people don't reason very well. Okay?
Yes.
So what logicians do is study norms of reasoning, not people how people actually reason.
Right.
Yeah, but
it's an idealized form of reasoning, common. But your paraconsistent logics, are they not applicable more to some kind of epistemic reasoning? Are you not trying to model how people in a way reason? You just said you aren't,
I leave that to cognitive psychologists.
So you wrote I haven't read this. You wrote a book about non-classical logics, and this is sort of lists stuff like intuitionism and some other logics and logics of which I would call epistemic. And what I wonder is, don't you think there is a difference between intuitionism and this what I would call epistemic logics, or is this just? It's all subsumed under non-classical, right?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by epistemic logics. There are epistemic logics, standardly so-called, and those are branches of modal logic. But a non-classical logic is any logic which is different from Frege-Russell logic. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the 20th century has seen the development of many, many, many non-classical logics. The book you're referring to that I wrote is a textbook, and it just goes through the gamut of many, by no means all, non-classical logics, explaining what they are.
The distinction is non-classical, right? You're in some sense interested in the notion of truth, whereas when I coming from intuitionistic logic, as I said already before, interested in the notion of evidence, and because for me, I mean, reasoning, I guess it's pure mathematics, is some kind of storytelling. And hence I find this sort of classical view, this Boolean view, completely misleading. But to me, the mathematics I think in or I work in is intuitionistic reasoning, is the idea of evidence is central. I think you said already that notion of evidence is not something which interests you particularly, or this identification is not something.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay, maybe I misunderstand you.
I said, I mean, if you want to know which contradictions are true, of course you have to engage with the evidence. But look, I'm not a philosophical intuitionist. I know that you are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Despite that, mm-hmm. I know what systems of intuitionistic mathematics are like. You know, I've read mm-hmm. many papers like Trelster and Dummett and so on. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I can investigate those when I mm-hmm. put my mathematical hat on. And mm-hmm. I know what moves are legitimate and what are not. Okay. And mm-hmm. there's perfectly good mathematics. I recognize an interesting mathematical structure when I see one. So even though I'm not a philosophical intuitionist, I understand intuitionist mathematics, and I'm happy to engage in that, you know, bit of pure mathematics sure. when the occasion arises. But I put it to you that you understand what classical mathematics is. So you know right. how to do classical real number theory. Oh, sure. I bet you were trained as a classical mathematician, and you know how to prove things in classical real number theory, all right? So, and you know that it's kind of interesting mathematics, interesting mathematical structures, right? So just like I'm not an intuitionist, but I can engage in intuitionist mathematics. You're not a classical logician, but you can engage in classical mathematics.
Sure.
So I don't, that's mm-hmm. not where the dispute lies.
No, but okay, may I add a bit to this? Yes, I mean, first of all, I wasn't educated as a mathematician. I was actually educated as a computer scientist, and hence lots of my intuition is based on what you can do with a computer in a way. So I sort of, to some degree, I would say I avoided this brainwashing which happens in math departments. I would say, and to me, I can formally do classical proofs, or I may sometimes also do classical reasoning myself, but it feels a bit like cheating. Yeah, something is left out. The reasoning doesn't seem to be. Seems to be a bit of imprecise reasoning, and the proofs are not very. They don't explain very well why I would accept some results. Right?
Well, I mean that's your view. I mean, we seem to have a philosophy of mathematics that are not the same, but of course, you can do constructive proofs. Shouldn't be identified with intuitionism, okay? But clearly constructive proofs give you more information than classical proofs.
Why not?
Oh, because why aren't... Well, because intuitionism is a form of constructivism, but as you know, there are other forms, right?
Okay, you mean like something like Markov's principles, Russian constructivism?
Well, there's a branch of mathematics called constructive mathematics, which uses... which reasons simply you only use constructive mathematical proofs, okay? But intuitionism mm-hmm. goes a long way beyond that, because if you simply do constructive mathematics, it's a fragment of classical mathematics. It's those things which you can establish with classical proofs. But in intuitionist mathematics, you can actually prove things which are not true in classical mathematics. For example, that every real-valued function is continuous. So intuitionism pushes things way beyond the bounds of simply constructive reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, true, in the sense of Dummett. Okay, I'm more a follower of Martin Löw, and we usually tend to be broadly consistent with classical reasoning. So
okay.
do these additional statements. Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know about your mathematical education, but I bet you learned I bet you learned to integrate and differentiate. So you know how to operate integrals and differentials, and I'm sure you use those all the time in your work, right? So I'm sure you know the theory of classical reals.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing much work on the real numbers. I'm interested in it, and especially, I mean, so my main area we're working on is something like type theory, and there's this new idea of homotopy type theory, which is I would say an alternative to set theory in a way. To me, well, I'm non-classical in the sense of I would say Martin Wolf type theory intuitionism. I find the idea of consistency quite important and useful
when I have a logical system. Well, it is in the area you work in.
Because in your branch,
the branch of mathematics that interests you, if you get a contradiction, you're in real trouble, right? But this is not the case in all pure mathematical structures.
But by the way, I mean, so sometimes, especially when we do formal proofs, they can get quite complicated. Mm-hmm. And so then temporarily you accept, you work in an inconsistent theory because it makes life easier. So one example is like the predicative hierarchy of types. I mean, there's types, different levels. If you quantify all types, you always raise a level. Also, if you quantify all propositions, you raise your level. And keeping tracks of these levels can be quite technically complicated. So sometimes I just say, okay, let there be a type of all types, and I work on this inconsistent theory. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether I can get some help here from you. I mean, to me, it's more like a meta. It's like, okay, something I know I'm cheating, yeah, and I'd rather avoid this, but for practical reasons, I'm quite happy to cheat for a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, mathematicians usually do not reason formally. Okay, if you open a page of any mathematics journal, you will not see any formal proofs.
Yeah, sure.
Reason sort of heuristically, and we think that in the end it could probably be formalized. But often that's just a sort of an assumption, and it can be a well-grounded assumption. But when you make the sort of assumption that you've been talking about, you probably make the assumption that it's not really essential, it's just convenient, and it could be dispensed with when you do things, mm-hmm. you know, in a kosher fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people do naive set theory all the time, which we know to be inconsistent, sure. but it's usually there's an assumption that when we do this, it can be legitimized in Zermelo-Frankel set theory or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes it's literally a ritual, right? You just say it at some point. Oh, I chose my right extension of ZFC, but not a minute was spent whether you are even using ZFC, so to speak. Maybe it's just PA. But
I think that's true.
That's interesting.
I mean, on the other hand, there are more and more mathematicians who are interested in doing formal proofs. I mean, we have just Kevin Buzzard on this, and there are famous, I mean, examples where mathematicians published proofs which then they had to recognize themselves were flawed, right?
Yes,
and
indeed so.
To avoid this situation, I think increasing number of mathematicians, or some mathematicians, start using proof assistance and computer-based tools.
Yes, that's true.
To formalize their results. Something which is changing.
That's right. Well, in fact, I was up at Rensselaer Institute of Technology last week talking to people who work on computational proof. And I was told, I believe these things that I'm told, that it's now been established by sort of systematic studies that something like 30% of proofs that appear in mathematics journals are actually wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been discovered
often they can be fixed. Yeah.
Well, hopefully, yeah.
But not always.
It might depend on the area a little bit. In graph theory, people would agree or say most it's like very local errors. There is some indices wrong, but the proof idea goes through. But of course, even that might fail and the theorem still might be true.
Of course, that's true. It doesn't mean the proof is right. It means it's repairable.
But sometimes it can be quite hard. So I think, Vladimir Vovotsky, he got interested in formal proofs as well, because he published a proof which he later discovered was wrong. And I think, so often what you need to do is you need to add some assumptions, or you need to be more precise what you're actually assuming. So actually the theorem in its most general form still fails, but can be salvaged.
But if you're dealing with formal proofs, there's a question of what the formal system of logic is you're using that you need to formalize. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you formalize an intuitionist proof, you're going to be involved in a different system of formal proof than if you're formalizing a classical proof.
Yes. So, I mean, we use this idea that this explanation propositions as types, I mean, a la Martin Löf, right? So that I understand the proposition by having an element of the type of evidence for it, yeah. And there's a very natural way to assign to propositions the type of evidence. So that's maybe in a way interesting, because if you go like you talk about naive set theory, so Cantor identifies the notion of a set with the notion of a predicate in some sense. It turned out that not every predicate corresponds to a set, so you have to restrict ZF or ZFC, where you have to restrict the collections which you can form. In type theory, it's the other way around. You start with collections, and then propositions are emergent in a way.
Could I use that to ask, or maybe if you want to comment on that? Do you think it's possible to give like a very rough idea how paraconsistent axiomatic set theories look like? Where is there the tweak, so to speak, from the naive conceptions? Or do you think it's too technical to give a idea that's feasible?
No. I think one can say a few simple things, which will probably do what you want. So, in a moment ago, when I talked about naive set theory, I was just talking about reasoning informally, okay? But naive set theory has a kind of technical sense nowadays, which is different. And it's as follows. It takes us back to this assumption that any condition defines a set. All right? We know that leads to contradiction. And the sort of in Zermelo-Frankel set theory, what you do is drop that assumption. You don't assume that every condition defines a set, okay? But a naive set theory in the contemporary technical sense is a sense where you retain the assumption that every condition defines a collection. So you've got a set of all sets, a set of all sets that are not members themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, you're likely to get contradiction when you do that. So if you do that, you cannot use an explosive logic like intuitionistic logic or classical logic, you have to use a paraconsistent logic. Which paraconsistent logic gives you a nice, smooth mathematical system? That's still a matter that's being debated. What is known is that certainly if for a number of paraconsistent logics, if you use the kind of naive principle that every condition defines a set, the theory you get is non-trivial. You cannot prove everything, and that's provable. Okay. Of course, if you But some paraconsistent logics will give you triviality independent of inconsistency, because there's a paradox of self-reference called Curry's paradox. And if you have certain principles about the conditional, then you're going to get triviality. So we know that some paraconsistent logics will blow up, even if you're using the naive set theoretic principle, some will not. And then there's another very interesting question of, if you want to recapture sort of standard results of set theory about transfinite cardinals and ordals and so on, are there paraconsistent logics which are strong enough to do that without blowing up in your face? And that was an open question for a long time. But that question was answered affirmatively by Zach Weber maybe 15 years ago now. So there's a lot of research still going on in this area. But the bottom line of your question is, yes, you can have a set theory which uses the naive assumption that every condition determines a set. Question, what is the best underlying paraconsistent logic to give you a smooth theory of the infinite in these situations? And we know quite a lot about that, but there are still a number of open questions.
May I ask, you talk about set theory, if we now come from type theory, so we have the same kind of paradox, right? If you have a type of all types, yes, you get an inconsistent type theory.
Yes.
Are these ideas of power consistency applicable in this context?
Look, I don't know, because I never studied them very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, if you are seriously operating with an inconsistent system, and it's not just as kind of to make life easy for yourself, you can't be using intuitionist logic. Could you do this with a paraconsistent logic? In principle, yes. In practice, I don't know the result. But
so there is no paraconsistent type theory, are you saying?
No, that, as
or nobody
as
has
know,
looked at this yet.
As far as I know, there isn't a well-articulated paraconsistent type theory, any more than there's a well-articulated paraconsistent category theory, where you know something similar happens, because you can have a category of all categories, and category theorists tend to reason about the category of all categories, but I think when they do so in an informal way, informal in the sense of pre-formalized. Whether or not you can sort of nail down the formalization in category theory with the category of all categories, or type theory with the type of all types, that I don't know. You'd have to ask someone who's more familiar with the area than I am.
Sure. By the way, we have got in type theory another issue with the category of all categories. It is not to do with size, it's with when are two things equal, when are two types equal. That's quite a difficult notion. So there is a category of all what the category of all categories is actually a higher category. It's not an ordinary category. So it's a bit of a different emphasis. It's when you talk about naive set theory, the issue seems to be size, right? This hierarchy of sets. But
it is in the Miller-Frankel set theory. Set theory, size makes no difference, because every condition, whatever defines a set, so size becomes irrelevant. But of course, it's highly relevant to the Miller-Frankel set theory.
Size is the issue which causes these paradoxes, I would say. Ignoring size, because once you say, if I quantify over all sets, I get something which is a bigger set, a class or something, then the issue disappears, right? So that's what I mean, these paradoxes which you overcome have to do with size, right?
That's one solution to the paradox of set theory, to say very large totalities are not sets. And that's the sort of solution that's implemented in the Miller-Frankel set theory. Mm-hmm. But there are other set theories which work on different principles.
Mm-hmm. in type series, there's a similar solution which is called universe. The universe of all types and of all small types is a larger type. So yeah, it's very similar. I'm just pointing out that there is another issue with these totalities, like the category of all categories is not a category, and this is not just. So size is actually quite easy to address in a way by introducing this hierarchy, but there is another issue. Is that the complexity of objects is increasing, which may not have anything or may not be related to this paraconsistent
idea. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. But may I ask one last block, because our potential next guest, or hopefully our next guest, might also say something about Hegel, and that's why I wanted to invite you. So you mentioned at the very beginning Hegel. You also mentioned Eastern philosophy, which would be also a very nice path to go. But for the connection to the next guest, what's Hegel doing in all this? Was he interested in formal logic, or how to get
not
him into
in the modern sense? Because there was no formal logic in the modern sense when he was around. He was actually quite knowledgeable of the mathematics of his day. So in the logic, you find the discussion of various topics in the philosophy of mathematics of his day, particularly infinity and infinitesimals and the calculus. I mean, you find those things discussed. But obviously he wasn't a philosopher of mathematics in any interesting sense. Well, I mean, Hegel scholars might disagree, but that's my view. All right. But Hegel is certainly a dialetheist. He clearly endorses contradictions. So, for example, in the logic, when he's discussing motion, he's concerned with what motion is. And he says, look, what is it to be in motion? Now, you might think that to be in motion is to be here at one point of time and here as another. And he said, that's wrong. That can be true even though the thing is stationary here at one time and here at another time. He says, to be in motion is to be both here and not here, but at one and the same time. And that's unquote in German, of course. So he says that motion realizes contradictions. An object in motion is both where it is and already somewhere else, maybe because it's gone a little bit further already, or maybe not quite got there yet. So that Hegel is a dialetheist, I think, is ungainsayable. Another example, in his discussion of the liar paradox in his lecture on the history of philosophy, when he talks about Eubulides, he says the liar paradox is both true and false. And if you only have one of these, then you only got half the story. So that he's a dialetheist, I think, is ungainsayable. Now, the much more interesting question is, what role does contradiction play in his systematic philosophy? And if you're talking about that, you're talking about the dialectic. And it's clear that contradiction is integral to the dialectic. Now, how? That's another question, and that's a much more contentious question.
And we will compare it to how Hegel can also be used in the foundation of mathematics next time.
Excellent. Who have you got talking on Hegel?
It's not confirmed yet, so we hope to get Urs Schreiber there. And you also had some ideas how, I think his approach somehow comes from Hegel's idea of nothingness and how to start up things from zero.
Okay.
And he has also formalized this in some model logic, but I'm no expert in it. I will need to read the NLAP, and that's always time consuming for me.
Yeah. There are a number of people who have tried to formalize Hegel. I think this produces some very interesting ideas. How good they are, I think, is highly contentious.
I mean, it's also a hard topic, so to speak, because the audiences are so different, right? Because I wouldn't think about a formal logician and a Hegel scholar at the same time. Maybe I should, but I think the Frege scholar would be closer to logic normally, so to speak.
That's true. Look, by far the best former logician who's engaged in Hegel that I know is a German logician called Uwe Petersen, who used the techniques of substructural logic to articulate Hegel's ideas. And Uwe is still working, I believe. He's in Hamburg. So if you want to talk about formal logic if you're interested in a good formal logician who knows his Hegel, then Uwe will be a terrific person.
Yeah, thanks for the pointers. Okay, so if you don't have a very pressing question.
No.
Graham, if you don't think that there's anything you need to say to qualify. I mean, we haven't talked about
politics. No, we've opened up many, many interesting issues. And of course, there's a lot more to be said about all of them. But time, especially for a podcast, is very finite. So that's okay.
Yeah, then thank you very much for your time, for these lovely insights and different ideas. And
you're welcome.
I think pragmatically, you turned us a little more pluralistic simply for teasing so many interesting topics. Okay, then have a great day and see you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.